Should you be wearing a mask in Memorial Day crowds? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Another pandemic holiday in South Florida with big crowds and events expected. It's the first major holiday since the Centers for Disease Control changed its mask recommendation. Do you plan on masking up if you're going out for Memorial Day? Also, the state plans to close vaccination sites in Miami-Dade County and testing sites throughout the region. So what's the latest on the virus? Plus, the extra federal unemployment money ends in 1 month. How are wages affecting the push to return to work in South Florida? And when does street art become advertising, especially in Wynwood, with millions of tourists? It's all ahead with your phone calls and tweets on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public radio. Floridians collecting unemployment will see their weekly payments cut by more than 50% in a month. Beginning June 26th, Florida will no longer pass along an extra $300 a week in federal unemployment money. It means the maximum amount of money someone on unemployment here in the Sunshine State can receive will be $275 a week. Now, some companies have been complaining about not being able to find enough workers. The local labor force has shrunk by more than 100,000 people since the beginning of the pandemic. But it's not just unemployment payments that may be keeping workers from returning. There are childcare concerns, after all, health worries, and wages. Now, in a few minutes here on the South Florida Roundup live on this Friday afternoon, we'll be talking about returning to the workforce and wages. And we want to hear from you. Are you on the sidelines of this pandemic job market recovery? Have you tried finding a new job but have been unsuccessful? Have you switched careers or rethought about your relationship with work because of COVID-19? We want to take your calls and your tweets in a few minutes, but line them up now. Share your experiences with us. Here's that phone number, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. You can also share your experiences on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle. Be sure to tag us. First up this week, it is expected to be the busiest weekend at South Florida airports since the pandemic began more than 14 months ago this coming weekend. Hundreds of thousands of travelers will be moving through the region's airports. More will be driving. People will be crowded on the water and on the sand for this first major holiday since the Centers for Disease Control revised its mask recommendations. The number of COVID cases has been dropping. The positivity rate has been falling. And the number of people getting vaccinated has been climbing. So, will you be wearing a mask if you're out and about over the Memorial Day weekend? We've seen infections rise after previous holidays. Will this time be different? You can share your experiences with us, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Veronica Zaragovia is the healthcare reporter here at WLRN, back with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Veronica, some vaccination and testing sites are due to be closed soon. Which sites and why?
Right. So what's happening, Tom, is that the state is transitioning to leave vaccination distribution to county health departments and local providers like doctor's offices and pharmacies and clinics. So these are sites that will remain open through roughly June 18th to June 25th. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of them, though, are going to remain open. They're just going to be managed at the local level. So to give you an example, Miami-Dade College North Campus has been a site that we've been reporting about mm-hmm. for a long time, and it is now being managed by Miami-Dade County. So it's not that all of them are going to disappear. They'll just transition, and then you can always still get vaccinated at your local Publix or CVS or Walgreens. So there will still be options, as well as a lot of pop-up sites that we'll talk about.
Yes, we will talk about those pop-up sites. What about options for testing? Because those big sites, Hard Rock Stadium, some of the parks in Broward County were popular options for people who wanted to just drive by, pop in and get a quick test.
That's right. And I was really worried about that because, say, also here in Miami Beach Convention Center, all of that is now either they've closed or they're ending today. So what the Florida Division of Emergency Management told me is that they have a link that we have also on our, we have a page on our website at wlrn.org with how to get tested. And so they're updating a list at floridadisaster.org, but you can find that on our site as well, where they have updated testing sites close to where these other sites were, and they need to be free. So I called Walgreens today actually just to check, and they said, yes, the test is free if you go to a Walgreens that has a testing capability. So unfortunately, it just will mean a little more looking around to find that test. That's very important to do.
Yeah, Veronica, stick with us. We want to welcome back to the South Florida Roundup Dr. Joshua Lentjes, the Chief Medical Officer of Broward Health Medical Center. Doctor, welcome back to the program. But what's the state of the virus in the community here on the eve of this long holiday weekend?
Thanks for having me back, Tom. It's always a pleasure to speak to you and your audience. As you mentioned in the opening, the numbers have significantly decreased, which is incredibly positive. When you look at the 2 weeks in the past leading up to today, both in Florida and here locally in the Miami-Dade, Broward County markets, they're all registering at under 5% mm-hmm. positivity as a rolling average. So very, very encouraging.
Very encouraging there on the positivity rate. Memorial Day and masks. Let's talk about that, Doctor. And Maria in Miami, we'll take your phone call in a moment here. This is the first major holiday after the CDC has kind of changed its messaging around those who are fully vaccinated and masks. What's the best practice, generally speaking, Doctor?
Well, the best thing to do would be to continue to wash your hands and try to get vaccinated as quickly as you can if you're going to pursue that option, because as the CDC has recently demonstrated, there are opportunities for you not to have to wear your mask or socially distance from others. So that would really be the best thing to do. And I think, as you mentioned as well in the opening, one of the things that is very different from the holiday season that we encountered at the beginning of the year is just the sheer number of people that have been vaccinated and have allowed that 2 week mark to pass since that vaccination, where we know that that's really the point of greatest protection.
Yeah, the CDC guidance now is fully vaccinated people, meaning if it's the Moderna or Pfizer both shots, or if it's the Johnson & Johnson that one shot, and then 2 weeks, that's fully vaccinated, those folks can resume, quote, activities without wearing a mask or physically distancing except where required. We should note that in airports, public transportation, some businesses are still requiring masks. But, Doctor, let me ask you, since teenagers were not able to be vaccinated, most, at least until earlier this month, few teenagers are fully vaccinated if you just look at the calendar. So should they continue to wear masks?
Yeah, I would recommend that at this point. You know, that age group has only recently been afforded the opportunity to pursue the Pfizer vaccine. Earlier this week, Moderna did release its results in its 12 to 17-year-old age range and will be similarly filing with the FDA for emergency use authorization. But for now, yes, we still continue to see both at a state and a more local level that the greatest incidence of COVID cases are occurring in presently the 25 to 34 year old age group, but certainly below that, you still have cases that are coming to bear.
Dr. Joshua Lentjes is the Chief Medical Officer of Broward Health Medical Center. Stick with us, Dr. Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter at WLRN, also with us talking about Memorial Day, masks, the state of the virus here in South Florida. 800-743-WLRN. Will you be wearing your mask even if you're fully vaccinated as you're out and about on the water or the sand, perhaps, this Memorial Day weekend? 800-743-WLRN. Maria is in Miami. Maria, nice to have you. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you. Hi, sure. Yes, I will absolutely be wearing my mask. I am fully vaccinated. And what I think is interesting is that I never questioned the science. Like, when I was told to get vaccinated, social distance and mask, I did immediately. But now, like, even with the guidance, I'm still hesitant. And I'm not sure why that is, but I will continue to wear my mask even though I am fully vaccinated.
Yeah, Maria, you bring up a great point. And Veronica, when we hear about vaccine hesitancy or folks that want to delay a vaccine, some of the argument for the CDC to drop the mask requirement or recommendation for those who are fully vaccinated was to send a message that getting vaccinated allows one to return to normal behavior. But they're, you know, Maria, fully vaccinated, hesitant to drop the mask when in public.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think the main thing is to not worry what others are thinking. And if it makes you feel safer to keep the mask on, we still have a situation where so many people have yet to get vaccinated. However, if you do get vaccinated, you might enjoy as we enter the summer months and it's maybe a little harder to sit outside to eat a meal, you might feel a little safer eating inside a restaurant. So it really is such a personal choice, but I certainly know from experts and Dr. Lentz that keeping that mask on is a smart thing to do while we continue to work our way through this pandemic.
Dr. Lentz, are you concerned at all about the falling pace of vaccinations? In other words, any one person getting vaccinated, of course, is going to increase the vaccination data and statistics, but the number of people getting vaccinated daily is falling kind of week over week.
Yeah, very, very interesting observation, Tom. Yeah, I think initially in the run-up to the vaccines being released at the end of December, we I think collectively in the medical community thought there was going to be a larger uptake with the demand for the vaccines. I think what we saw is we saw a tremendous increase in demand, a pent-up demand in that run-up, and we saw tremendous numbers getting a vaccine in the end of the December into January. We do see this kind of variation over the last several weeks in the number of vaccines that are coming out. And I think that the hope is that with this opening up down to the 12-year-olds to really help increase the number of people that are vaccinated. But also, I think that there, to your point earlier about vaccine hesitancy, remember, we're only almost 6 months into our vaccination efforts here. And I think that there are still some people that want to see those long-term effects. And every day that goes by, we're able to cull additional data. Yeah. Vaccine science, the science that brought these vaccines to market were based on tens of thousands of people. Now around the world, we're pushing 1.8 billion doses of the vaccine that have been administered. So it really gives us a tremendous data repository to show that these vaccines are in fact safe. And the efficacy part, the effectiveness of the data that we have shows that, and I'm sure that this is why the CDC moved to its relieving some of the mask mandate, is it shows that fully vaccinated people have no chance of conveying that infection to somebody even asymptomatically. So if you're fully vaccinated and you get infected, the vaccine will work for you, and it will also work to prevent you from spreading that infection to someone else. And I think that that's some of the science that informed their decision.
Yeah, such an important point, and the CDC did exactly point to just that learning as we're 6 months into the vaccination process globally, and as that learning has evolved, thus the kind of mask recommendations have evolved. Regarding the pace of vaccinations, Veronica, about 48% of the adult population in Broward County is fully vaccinated, about 52% in Miami-Dade County, about 49% in Palm Beach County. So roughly one out of every two people who are 18 years old or older in South Florida are fully vaccinated now. Talk to us about the pop-up vaccine sites. What are those? How are those being used to try to increase that percentage of adult vaccination?
Right. Those continue as experts tell me, well, the supply is there. So the issue is demand. And a lot of people feel it's not that they're adamantly against getting a vaccine, but people work multiple jobs or they're single parents that I've interviewed and just need the vaccination process to be right there. They really, even though it doesn't sound like a long drive to drive 15 minutes to a vaccination site, for some people it's very difficult. Yeah. So now they're bringing vaccines to the sand. I mean, this weekend, you'll be able to find, for instance, in downtown Lake Worth Beach, there will be vaccinations. On Hollywood Beach, there will be vaccinations. Miami Beach. So they're doing those kinds of things. At Miami International Airport has had vaccinations, Port Miami. So sometimes if you work somewhere, you just can't take the time off to get a shot. So a lot of counties are taking it on to make it as accessible as possible. And so that's what I've been seeing.
really targeting some of the hospitality industry with the Miami International site, Port Miami, mm-hmm. Port Everglades, parking lots or parking garages near hotels have been offered up as pop-up sites. And coming up, we're going to be talking about the workforce, and vaccinations play such a big part in people returning to the workforce. And we want to hear your thoughts on that. If you've been looking for a job, waiting for vaccinations in order to get back into the workplace, 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number to share your experiences live on this Friday, 800-743-9576. We're talking about the state of COVID-19 ahead of the Memorial Day holiday weekend in South Florida with Veronica Zaragovia, our healthcare reporter here at WLRN, and Dr. Joshua Lentjes, the chief medical officer of Broward Health Medical Center. It is expected to be an awfully busy Memorial Day weekend at the airports where masks are still required on the sand, on the water. Dr. Lentjes, as folks in South Florida, where vaccination rates are about 50%, could be traveling to places where vaccination rates are much below 50% and coming back. How should we look at some of the data in the weeks ahead to gauge kind of where we are in this pandemic? Because we've seen spikes after previous holiday weekends.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. I mean, ultimately, time will tell. I think within the next 2 weeks after this weekend, we'll be able to assess where we are. And if we have a blip, I would not expect that that would be to the same degree or depth that we've seen after previous holidays when vaccination rates were much lower. And remember, for the folks that are traveling in the audience, we here in Florida, or even locally in the South Florida area, have our restrictions, if you will. But the places that you're going to may be very different. And I would encourage them to, obviously, they don't want to skirt the law in wherever they're going to. Just be careful around the people that you're around.
Yeah. And talk to us about the variants that are circulating. We know the UK variant, Brazilian variant, those were found in South Florida, prevalent in South Florida. The big concern now in the epidemiology community seems to be this so-called Indian variant.
Yeah, very timely. In fact, when you look at the government data on the CDC website, there's about 70% of the variants that we have in the state of Florida are from the UK. Probably another 10% or so are from the Brazilian variant. The Indian variant is of recent concern, but we haven't really seen that yet outside of that local area. So the CDC has names variants in terms of concern or interest. I don't know to the lay population that means much of a difference, but we haven't really seen as much of the Indian variant here in the States as they've seen, obviously, in Europe. I think the most important thing to say, though, is in terms of the vaccine's effectiveness against these variants.
Right.
And while the vaccines came to market with the 95% effectiveness, or give or take, the vaccines do show effectiveness against these variants, perhaps to a lesser degree, but still there is protection against it. So to the vaccine hesitancy point that you mentioned earlier, if somebody was hesitant about getting a vaccine because they were worried it wasn't going to work against one of the variants that are circulating out there that we're concerned about, that should allay some of that fear that those tests have been done against the variants that have been out for a little bit longer and are currently being done against the Indian variant that's out in Europe.
What do we know about the fully vaccinated ability to transmit or not transmit a variant of the virus versus the traditional virus version?
Yeah, that's you know, if I had the answer to that question, I'd be leading a government agency, I think. You know, but it's very insightful, because the bulk of the data that we're getting about effectiveness of the vaccines is born out of Israel, where more than 80% of their general population has already been vaccinated. Now, of course, they started vaccinating in the early part of December of last year, so not a lot of variants were out at that time. Some of the variants have made their way there, but they seem to be doing very well, although the population of Israel is about 9 million. So it's not a huge population to assess. What we have seen, though, is within the states, and specifically in Florida, where that UK variant is about 7 out of 10, we're still seeing the decrease, a significant decrease, in the ability of having those breakthrough infections or the ability to transmit that. In fact, just last week or earlier this week, they looked at breakthrough infections where these are people that are fully vaccinated who had an infection themselves in the ability to and the ability to transmit it to other people. And the number is less than 1% of the total population. And in fact, it was so small that the CDC changed the way they looked at those infections of fully vaccinated folks and are now only reporting people that either are so sick that they're hospitalized or that they die. And just to put some at ease, I don't want to end on a bad note there. There's less than 2,000 of those cases out of the more than 123 million people that have been vaccinated as of a week ago. So it's not very common.
One other comment that we've heard, and Veronica, you've reported on this, of folks that are hesitant about the vaccine will say, well, I had COVID. I tested positive. Maybe I was asymptomatic. Maybe I did have symptoms. So I've got the antibodies. For those that did test positive that had the virus, do they still need to be vaccinated?
Well, I certainly would love to hear from Dr. Lynch's, but from what I understand from what doctors have said is that it's still not the same immunity that you'd build from having had the virus. So it's definitely recommended to get a shot, but you'd need to wait a certain amount. I don't know, Dr. Lynch's, if you can help us there.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, the thing between the difference between getting a vaccination and getting infected is really in the load. It's the amount of infectivity that the virus transmits. So for somebody that's not vaccinated, it may take a much lower amount of infection in order to cause you to have symptoms and in fact be infected. Your body then responds in kind. The vaccines provide a much larger stimulus to your immune system, so you develop higher levels of antibody and immunity. Yeah. For people that have already had a natural COVID infection, we recommend generally as early as 2 weeks after that infection to probably as long as about 90 days or so, which is within the time span of your natural immunity. After about 90 days of you being infected, then your natural immunity will taper off. When you look at somebody that has never had COVID and was vaccinated, after 90 days, their levels of antibodies are much higher. Hmm. And in fact, earlier this week, there was a report that said that now they're looking at people that were infected May of 2020, and they're still seeing some level of antibody, but not nearly at the level of protection that we're seeing 6 months after the first people were vaccinated.
Dr. Joshua Lynch's is the Chief Medical Officer of Broward Health Medical Center. Dr. Lynch's, thanks so much for sharing your time and expertise with us again.
Thank you, as always, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Veronica Zaragovia, healthcare reporter at WLRN. Always appreciate your time and your reporting, Veronica. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much to you, Tom.
Still to come, we're going to be talking about returning to the workforce. Not returning to workplace, but the workforce. If you've been without work and have been looking for work or have been frustrated with the workplace, let us know. 800-743-WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. After more than a year of economic turmoil brought on by the coronavirus pandemic, businesses are bouncing back, but help wanted and now hiring signs are abundant throughout South Florida and the entire state for that matter. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis speaking in Miami on Monday.
No matter where I go in the state of Florida, people will tell me, Florida's great. Thanks for what you're doing, Governor. We just need to find more people to want to work.
All right. So did you experience a pandemic-related job loss? Have you switched jobs or started working in a new industry over the last year? Have you not yet re-entered the workforce after being laid off? We want to hear from you now live on this Friday. Share your experiences. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Florida is ending the extra federal unemployment payments in 1 month. Despite the job bounce back, there are still over 200,000 fewer people working in South Florida than before the pandemic. One out of every 28 people have dropped out of the job market altogether in the region. So are you looking for work now? Are you a discouraged worker, someone who's quit looking for work? With the demand for workers increasing, what effect is that having on wages, especially in the lower paying jobs prevalent in South Florida in the hospitality industry? Help us get a better understanding of where we're at with South Florida's economic recovery and jobs by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Nika Ziranova is along with us, research specialist with Florida International University's Jorge M. Perez Metropolitan Center. Nika, thanks for your time today. Appreciate you joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So a lot of statistics here, but a lot of voices behind all these statistics of people in South Florida who continue to struggle for work. South Florida unemployment, 5.9%. Miami-Dade County, the highest in the state at 6.9% in April. What is the shape of the regional job market now?
Well, first of all, I wanted to start with comparison from the last year and the overall labor force participation in Miami metropolitan area historically has been on par with the national rate. Mm-hmm. In February of 2020, the Miami metropolitan area had 3.2 million strong workforce. But in March 2021, the labor force had decreased by almost 5%.
Yeah.
And Miami-Dade specifically lost 7.2% of its workers. Specifically, if you look at the current numbers and you see some positive changes in April, you get 10% increase of total employment, and you get to see a significant increase in leisure and hospitality sector. Mm-hmm. However, if you look at the numbers pre-pandemic, they are still significantly lower across the Tri-County area, specifically in leisure and hospitality. In Miami-Dade County, it's almost 36,000 of total jobs lower from pre-pandemic level, 11,000 lower in Broward County, and 14,000 lower in Palm Beach County.
We have to be really careful with some of these statistics as we're now more than a year into the pandemic, right, Nika? Where year over year comparisons really aren't going to matter because things were so bad in March and April of 2020 that not that they could only get better, but they're going to look great compared to last year. But we really have to look at that pre-pandemic, that January and February, or even the 2019 status of where things kind of looked like. Because as you mentioned, right, jobs are growing. They have come back. Labor force is growing. People are entering into the labor market again, wanting to work. But the labor market remains smaller than what it was before the pandemic. And there are tens of thousands of jobs that have not reappeared in South Florida. So on the labor pool side, and phone calls are coming in here, Nika, we're going to get to them in a moment. Why are folks who had been working or who were part of the workforce, say, 18 months ago before the pandemic, why are they not part of the labor force today? What are some of those reasons?
Oh, well, one of the reasons, obviously, wages and skyrocketing housing prices. People who are employed in low wage occupations cannot simply afford either rents or even afford a home. So we've seen a lot of movement from Miami-Dade County to Broward County, and people from Broward County moving to Palm Beach or elsewhere to Orange County, Martin County, or even a different coast to Lee County, similar to Palm Beach County as well.
Yeah, chasing lower cost of living, or maybe even chasing the combination of lower cost of living and higher wages. So net-net, people are better off at the end. Some calls coming in here, Nika. Let's start in Miami, where Carla is online too. Carla, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you guys. It's a great show and always very, very informative. I am a single mom of two young kids. I'm re-entering the workforce, thank God, this month, and I'm very happy to. But I'm entering the workforce at less than half of what I was making before. I'm a paralegal, and I'm doing legal adjacent work in an office right now. But my two kids are both still home. They're both still doing virtual school. I have one that's just turned 4, so he's doing preschool things that I was doing with him on the computer. I live in a multi-generational home, so my parents are both with me as well. And I was furloughed on March 14th, the day that we all went into quarantine. The idea that I keep hearing sometimes in the media, and even from people that I've spoken to now that I'm out, saying that they're looking for people to fill jobs, but they feel like they're making the choice of whether or not to go to work or just sit at home. Nobody likes to sit at home. We've all been at home for over a year. And people want to go to work. But it's so many underlying factors that are in there. Not only am I a woman under 40 who has to choose between going to work and staying home with her kids and her family. I was the only one leaving the house for over a year. And I was denied unemployment benefits. So I've maxed out my 401k, I've gone through everything, and I'm down to zero again. And I have built a career up until now. So for that fallacy to continue to be perpetuated, it's insulting, and it's just terrible. And it begs the question for the underlying factors that we're still working on, trying to figure out how can we provide people with a living wage in order to find the kind of people that you want to fill these jobs.
Yeah. Carla, I don't want to let the big news go by there too quickly there, but congratulations on the new job. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be back talking to adults again.
Well, your kids are.
I already know my ABCs, and I'd like to do some other things with it.
Yeah, sounds like your kids have been lucky to have you. But I appreciate you sharing your story because it really highlights, Carla, a lot of the forces at play here, Nika. Right, the wage at which people will be attracted to come back into the workforce, Carla, and childcare is an issue, multi-generational. So I would suspect there's some healthcare, you know, concerns about not wanting to bring the virus into the house if you go back out into the workplace. So lots of forces there really at play with Carla as she is entering this workplace and this environment that she's walking into, Nika.
Yes, absolutely. And I wanted to point out, we recently published a policy brief, When Work Disappears, Splitting the Post-COVID Economy. We outline broader policies and strategies related to industry development and workforce reskilling and upskilling. But the success of these strategies is also linked to re-engagement of discouraged and marginally employed workers that require addressing the barriers to entry and retention of this workforce. We also outline like different segments by age, because we couldn't approach the elderly or older population the same way we would address the youth. So keeping older workers employed will probably require federal action on a number of fronts, including changes to Social Security, Medicare eligibility. Younger segments, a different story. Local institutions have a vital role to play in this job prep training. They're working along state partners. It's also vital sources for labor market linkages. And also local institution also provide us for affordable quality daycare, which is a critical ingredient for families.
You just heard that from Carla in Miami, as a matter of fact. Let's go to Naples. Robert is listening online. Robert, go ahead. Thanks for listening. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you. First time caller, long time listener. I agree with what everyone's been saying here when it comes to the workforce, places not reopening. My question is, though, I wonder what the political calculation is from DeSantis, where Florida has been in the news and the media, pretty much having not only the most stingy unemployment social safety net in the country, but also had some of the worst rollout that we've had. Most people not receiving benefits, you know, still fighting with unemployment, not being able to get through, which is still to the point to this day. And the reopening not really happening. And finally, when things start working, for him to make the decision to pull out of the federal benefits when he's finally got things working. Is this a political calculation that he sees something I don't, or is it he just in the pockets of big corporations like Walmart and Publix and Target that are experiencing these labor shortages that have done nothing but benefit from low wages and a pandemic that forced everyone to close but themselves?
Robert, I'll let you kind of come to your own conclusions about the politics there, but let's talk about just the math of unemployment benefits here, Nika, because Robert is putting voice to some, and he's right? We've heard from some in the economic community, in the business community, pointing to higher unemployment benefits for holding back an increasing labor pool, not having, being discouraging for workers to come back to work because of higher unemployment benefits. So the maximum now and through the end of June in Florida with the federal money is $575 a week. That's $275 from the state unemployment, the $300 a month booster. That works out based on a full-time job, $14.38 an hour, pre-tax, less than $30,000 a year. So Nika, what influence do you think that these payments have on whether or not people are into the workforce? force into the labor pool?
Well, it's definitely, if you have only 13 an hour, you cannot afford living in South Florida, unfortunately. But even if you look at the job postings that are currently being put out by major employers, it's $21 an hour, which is a little bit higher than 13, but it still translates to, what is it, $41,000, $42,000 a year. You will be spending more than 50% of your income on housing.
Right. And in Florida, the state minimum wage is due to go up to $10 an hour in September under a voter-approved constitutional amendment on its way to $15 an hour by 2026. Are you seeing, Nika, that to be influencing wages at all, or is it simply just the demand for workers and the amount of money that companies are having to pay to attract people into jobs?
Well, it certainly would have an impact on the overall employment, but also some of the businesses, which are mostly small businesses, like 80% of businesses in Miami-Dade are small businesses, which employ less than 10 workers. But what does it mean for them? Do you have to pay more in order to attract the workers, but you would have to fire someone from your labor pool?
Yeah. Eileen is in Miami on line 5. Eileen, thanks for listening and calling. You're on the radio.
Hi. I'm calling because I want to put in the thought that maybe some people have transferred over from working for other people to working for themselves. I noticed that a lot of businesses started up like family businesses. We had a donut man that used to come out on the weekends, and now he works every single day with lines going around the block, including he employs 3 or 4 people. So that helped him. But myself, I'm someone that worked selling flowers as an independent contractor, working for myself. And I also had to supplement that by working for a employer, working in a gas station. But since the pandemic, I have lost the people that sell flowers for me, and I had to transition. My knowledge of working with flowers is long time, so I had to stay with that. And what I did was I found that now I can work freeze drying flowers. So I'm in a position where I have to buy a machine. It costs $10,000, but I'd be in a better position to work for myself. And that's my goal right now. I also want to say that the unemployment system is totally screwed. Sorry to say it, but you know, there's payments that are being paid and then taken back from people, myself included. The federal government approves you for a certain amount of money, and before it's ever given to you, it's taken back, and then you're charged overcharge for things. It's bizarre. I don't know what's going on there, but there's money that's floating around that's not getting paid to the people, and I wonder where does that money go? But most of all, what I'm trying to point out is that people have transitioned, and it might not sound plausible, but a lot of people have found that they can work for themselves. Yeah. And it's going to take time for that to kick in and for the government to see that people are now working for themselves, because they don't always report at like every 3 months like they're supposed to. Sometimes they report at the end of the year. But that's also an option and a reason why people should still be able to collect, I guess, you know, the unemployment.
Yeah, Eileen, I appreciate the call and the perspective, and thank you for sharing the story there. Best of luck on the budding business, pun intended. It was a flower pun there.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And thank you for laughing kindly at my awful joke there. But Nika, what Eileen puts voice to is something interesting, and I've heard this from workers I speak to. I heard it with the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta president saying the pandemic has caused people to rethink their relationship with work and how they want to work, if they want to work for companies or themselves, how much they want to work, and the value of time has become kind of recalculated. Have you gotten a sense of that?
Absolutely. I mean, both from even the business owners and from workers themselves. So the biggest theme of this year, I guess, is the flexibility. Where you work, how you work, are you working remotely, are you going to come into the office once a week, twice a week? That's definitely a big thing, flexibility.
Yeah, flexibility, a big thing here. And you know, watching the labor market, watching the labor pool, employment in South Florida is so important here as we take a look at the pandemic economic rebound. Nika Ziranova with Florida International University's Jorge M. Perez Metropolitan Center. Nika, a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program here this Friday, commercial advertising among the street art in Miami's Wynwood neighborhood. Do the ads change the appeal of the area? I'm going to talk about the combination of art and commerce. Share your thoughts with us. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for supporting public radio. The buildings and sidewalks of Miami's Wynwood neighborhood have served as a canvas for local and international artists for decades. Millions of people visit each year to experience the area's intersection of art and grit. With so many people, cameras, and social media posts, it's a natural area for advertising. But should it be? The Wynwood Business Improvement District is fighting what it describes as the commercialization of the arts district. Some local artists say the advertisement murals are a good source of income. So when street art and advertising collide in South Florida, does commercialization change the character of this tourist place? It's one of those popular tourist attractions, so do you like the artistic twist on advertisements on the walls in Wynwood? 800-743-WLRN is our phone number, 800-743-9576. You can share your thoughts with us on Twitter. We're at WLRN. Lexi Cardona is with us, Miami New Times reporter who wrote about this in the latest issue. Describe these advertisement street murals in Wynwood, Lexi.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on. So the murals have really run the gamut. They've advertised beer and liquor, designer clothing brands, sneakers, music albums, food, Netflix series, TV shows. You get the idea. Yeah. A lot of these murals have advertised alcohol. So in the past couple of years, there have been a lot depicting products from companies that sell rum, vodka, hard seltzer, tequila, everything. And what's interesting about some of these murals is that a lot of them contain really beautiful, original, intricate works of art with some small commercial logos on them that you almost can't see. And others are very much in your face, very obviously advertisements.
Yeah, describe maybe some of those that are less obvious that arguably you could say are more art than advertising, but yet there is an advertising reference in them.
Absolutely. So I saw a photo of one mural recently that depicts a cheetah, a poison dart frog, and a colorful bird that I can identify. It looks like a forest. They look like they're just kind of emerging from the flora. And the caption read, "When you care for the land returns the favor." And you can almost perceive it as, you know, commentary on the environment, on animal conservation, what have you. But at the top left of the mural, there's a really small logo for Flor de Caña rum. That you could almost miss. And then there are the advertisements that are much more obvious, like one for Selena, the series on Netflix, and for the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reunion on HBO. And it's really just, you know, a caricature of Selena holding up a microphone, or, you know, Will Smith just kind of propped up on a wall in Wynwood.
Yeah, an homage or a painted billboard, I suppose, in the
Absolutely.
Eye of a beholder, maybe, right? Yuval Ofira is also with us here during our conversation. Yuval is the creative project director, consultant, cultural advocate, founder of the arts incubator, Yo Miami. Yuval, can these advertisements coexist with the traditional street murals in Wynwood?
Good afternoon, Tom, and a pleasure to be here. The simple answer is yes. I don't know if you want me to expand on that or if you want to move along.
But
as someone who's been active and working, who's produced both commercial projects and passion projects in Wynwood, as well as in Little Haiti, going as far back as 2012, I established the Little Haiti Mural Project in 2014. I personally have not made 1 cent off of that project. I have thankfully been able to get a number of artists paid through that project. And we strive to incorporate elements of Haitian and Caribbean culture into every mural that we produce there. Commercial and quote unquote artistic, or let's say non-commercial work, have to live side by side, and especially in an environment like Miami or South Florida, where there's very little support, and speaking in no uncertain terms, financial support for the artists creating this work. So when I first saw the article in question, and especially for me, what was laughable about the bid complaining about wanting to protect artistic integrity or looking out for the interests of the artist, is all the photos that were included in that article were captioned provided by the bid, yet for some reason they neglected or were not able to identify the artists who created those murals. The funny thing is, so the mural of the jaguar with the tree frog and the bird that Alexi mentioned is done by a good friend of mine, Ivan Roque. And I spoke to him actually about this article before coming on and what his feelings were about everything. And all of the artists, so he said, and he echoes the sentiments of pretty much every artist that I've spoken to since that article came out, which is, if you don't want us getting money from brands or sponsors to create commercial murals, put your money where your mouth is, because we have bills to pay, we have mouths to feed. And for an organization, and whether it's the bid or several of the developers who have held sway over Wynwood and dictated the direction in which it has grown over the past several years, who have not been supportive of the arts community, mm-hmm. and instead have found ways to market things like exposure and things like that as benefits for the artists to create their work there. You know, I, for me, it's a little bit laughable almost to hear them now saying, oh, it's getting too commercial. Well, you know, you're the one that, you know, you kind of brought it upon yourself. So it's hard for me to feel bad that now you're like, oh, it's losing some of its authenticity.
Alexi, what about this kind of soft benefit of artists, exposure, versus the hard benefit of hard currency that some of these advertisers or others may be offering?
Sure. The individuals that I talked to about this absolutely agree with Yuval on this matter that, you know, really exposure doesn't pay the bills. That's 100% true. And they do have bills to pay. They do have, you know, roofs to keep over their heads. And so it's kind of exactly what Yuval said, that matter of, you know, putting your money where your mouth is kind of what the artists say, because they believe it. You know, truthfully, their work has value, and what makes Wynwood a world-renowned destination is the art, is the artist, it is what they put on the walls. And so they do believe rightfully that they should be paid, that they should be compensated adequately for that work.
Yuval, let me ask you a simple question that may have a very complex answer, which is, who's paying for these advertisements, even if they're subtle advertisements, as Alexi described, the jaguar and the frog? Who's the client? Who's paying?
The simple answer is it's the brands which are being advertised. But if you want to make it a little, I won't get too down the rabbit hole, there are also, let's say, advertising and marketing agencies who are directed by. But in other words, the money, if you want to say where's the money coming from, it's from the brands who want quote-unquote grassroots organic way.
And
to
so then are they then partnering with the building owners that have the real estate, the walls?
It varies. There's a very wide spectrum of how that works. So in some cases, yes. In some cases, they're paying the property owners for use of the wall for a certain amount of time. In other cases, it's an agreement where basically it's not going to cost the property owner anything to beautify their building. And the company just covers all the costs associated with producing the mural, including paying the artist. So there's a big variety of how that works.
And is there like a time frame, like this advertisement 100%. Mural will be up for 90 days, 120 days, that kind of thing. So Alexi,
Sorry, just that is something that happens, but it's not always the case.
Gotcha. So in those instances, perhaps when it does happen, Alexi, are those kinds of deals running afoul of zoning rules in Wynwood, where a wall, which had been kind of a concrete canvas for art, now becomes more like a billboard?
According to the bid, and this is their position, it does run afoul of the city's zoning codes. The city's own planning and zoning code kind of governs where murals can and can't be displayed, even down to the types of materials that can be used in some cases. And there's quite a host of rules and a lengthy process to go through for somebody to create a mural. Anyone who wants to do that in the city of Miami can't do so unless they go through the process of applying, getting mural and building permits, paying fees, complying with a host of terms. If they change the terms of the art that they're going to create, they might have they risk losing the permit. If they don't comply with all these crazy terms, you know, they risk having their permit revoked anyway and being disqualified from ever applying for future mural permits in Wynwood. So it's quite a process. And according to the bid, some of the advertisement murals going up in Wynwood are unpermitted, and so that's one of the issues that, according to them, they're trying to fight.
Crazy in terms of the amount of regulations around the creation of art. It's one of the many fascinating pieces that you've got in your article, Alexi, and we do appreciate you sharing your reporting with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alexi Cardona with the Miami New Times, and you follow Fear with Yo Miami. Yuval, a pleasure to have you on as well. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Much appreciated. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup here on this Friday. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. We had assistance from Raquel Cornell Uribe. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Technical supervisor and director is Peter J. Maritz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, tweeting, listening, and supporting WLRN. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.